Benjamin Netanyahu has a message for UN peacekeepers in Lebanon.
It is time you take UNIFIL out of Hezbollah strongholds and combat areas. Your refusal to evacuate UNIFIL soldiers makes them hostages in the hands of Hezbollah.
American troops and a missile defense system are headed to Israel.
And already we've heard from senior Iranian officials. They have issued statements on X warning the U.S. about going through with this.
Plus, do you think the election is bad for your mental health? You're right.
Constantly exposing ourselves to negative information, negative images, negative rhetoric is going to elevate our overall sense of negativity and stress.
Today is Monday, October 14th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Karish in Washington. Israeli rescue services say at least 61 people have been wounded in a drone strike in the central Israeli city of Binyamina, three of them critically so. The Hezbollah militant group claimed responsibility for what is one of the most serious strikes to land in Israel in the year of war. Israel's advanced air defense systems mean that it's rare for so many people to be hurt by drones or missiles. It was not immediately clear who was hurt, military or civilian, or what was hit. In a separate attack, four Israeli soldiers were killed by a Hezbollah drone strike on a military base. All this as Israel's prime minister is urging UN peacekeeping forces to leave parts of war-torn Lebanon as Israel continues targeting Hezbollah there. His comments come after news that recent Israeli strikes injured five UN peacekeepers. VOA's Arash Arabasadi has the story.
Israel's air defenses light the night sky following a Hezbollah rocket barrage early Sunday morning. The fighting comes as Hezbollah continues hitting northern Israel for what the Western-identified terror group says is its support for Palestinians in Gaza after the October 7 Hamas terror attacks on Israel that led to all-out war. While Israel and Hezbollah in Lebanon continue cross-border attacks, civilians seek cover in a bomb shelter in the Israeli city of Haifa. And in recent days, Israeli strikes injured five UN peacekeepers known as UNIFIL in parts of Lebanon, where strikes across the country have killed 1,400 people as of September, according to Lebanon's health ministry. The ministry does not differentiate between Hezbollah fighters and civilians. UN Deputy Spokesperson Farhan Haq.
This is a serious development, and UNIFIL reiterates that the safety and security of UN personnel and property must be guaranteed, and that the inviolability of UN premises must be respected at all times.
Israel has made clear in public statements that it's not targeting attacks on the Lebanese people or UNIFIL, but rather Iran-backed Hezbollah. Following news of the injuries to UN peacekeepers, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu both issued an apology and a warning.
It is time you take UNIFIL out of Hezbollah strongholds and combat areas. Your refusal to evacuate UNIFIL soldiers makes them hostages in the hands of Hezbollah. It endangers them as well as our soldiers.
Parts of Lebanon have now been reduced to rubble and dust following Israeli strikes, a scene similar to Gaza, and one the White House does not want to see repeated. White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre at a briefing as provided by the AP.
We cannot and will not see Lebanon turn into Gaza, into another Gaza. That is not what we want to see. The suffering in both Gaza and Lebanon adds even greater urgency, as you've heard from us, to our efforts, certainly to end the conflicts and lay a foundation for lasting peace and security in the region.
Meanwhile, Israelis in Tel Aviv took to the streets for their weekly protests against Netanyahu's government on Yom Kippur, the highest of Jewish holidays. They continued demanding a ceasefire to help broker a hostage release deal to free those still held by Hamas in Gaza following the October 7 attacks. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News.
Meanwhile, NBC reports that U.S. officials believe Israel may target Iranian military and energy infrastructure in its response to Iran's missile attack earlier this month. Iran's foreign minister warned on Sunday that Iran will not hesitate when it comes to defending its people and interests. Diane Toh of Reuters has that story.
Rocket barrages by Iran-backed Lebanese armed group Hezbollah triggered sirens across northern Israel overnight and early Sunday morning. Israel's army said in a statement its forces intercepted the projectiles, while it also intensified its attacks in Lebanon. The Middle East is bracing for further escalation, as Iran's foreign minister warned in a social media post on Sunday that, quote, "We have no red lines in defending our people and interests." It follows a report by NBC that Israel may be looking to target Iranian military and energy infrastructure in its potential response to Iran's attack this month. NBC was citing unidentified U.S. officials in its report. Israel's defense minister has said the country will hit Iran back in a lethal, precise, and surprising way. According to NBC, the U.S. officials have seen no indication that Israel will target nuclear facilities or carry out assassinations in Iran. It also said Israel has not made final decisions about how and when to act. The report added that U.S. and Israeli officials believed a response could come during the Jewish Yom Kippur holiday. The holiday ended on Saturday with no strike from Israel. Iran's attack on October 1st was launched in retaliation for Israel's military operations in Gaza and Lebanon and the killings of a string of Hamas and Hezbollah leaders. On Saturday, Iranian Parliament Speaker Mohammed Bakar Kalibaf visited one of the sites in Lebanon's capital that was hit by Israeli airstrikes. Israel's Thursday attack on Beirut killed at least 22 people and wounded over 100. At a news conference, Kalibaf reaffirmed Iran's commitment to supporting Lebanon, saying it was a message directly from Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei.
That's Diane Toh of Reuters reporting for us. And as we've seen in the previous two stories, Israel is dealing with the threat of incoming missiles from Hezbollah in Lebanon and from Iran. To help its ally, the United States is sending a THAAD missiles defense system to Israel, and crucially, approximately 100 American troops to operate it. Will this move deter Israel's enemies from attacking, or will it be seen as America expanding the conflict further? For more, I'm joined by Will Todman. He's Deputy Director and Senior Fellow at the Middle East Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies.
Yeah, so this is one of the most advanced missile defense systems that the United States military operates, and it is specifically designed to shoot down ballistic missiles. And of course, Iran fired around 200 ballistic missiles at Israel just last week. And several of those missiles seem to have broken through Israel's other missile defense systems, including Iron Dome and the Patriot systems. So this is intended to beef up Israel's ability to defend itself from a future Iranian ballistic missile attack. It's qualitatively different because it's a really complicated missile system to operate. So around 100 U.S. troops are going to be deployed to operate these systems. And that's a first since the outbreak of this conflict on October the 7th last year, because until now, U.S. troops haven't been deployed to operate on Israeli soil.
And that's sort of the important news of today, isn't so much that Israel's getting this fancy new piece of hardware, but that actual American troops, American boots on the ground in Israel, will be defending Israel. And that's likely to be seen as a real step up by Israel's adversaries, no?
Yes, definitely. And already we've heard from senior Iranian officials. They have issued statements on X warning the U.S. about going through with this, saying, you know, keep your troops out of Israeli soil and they then won't be targeted. Until now, Iran has largely limited its strikes or its the missiles it has fired to military targets. But these U.S. troops will likely be operating from Israeli military bases. And so they will be in the direct line of fire if Iran does choose to carry out another round of retaliatory strikes. So there is certainly the risk that there could be U.S. casualties from an Israeli strike, and that would be a first. So there is definitely the risk that then that would very likely result in the U.S. itself striking Iran directly, some kind of kinetic strike, and then suddenly the U.S. is seen as an even more direct player in this conflict in the Middle East.
Now, the U.S., the Defense Department, State Department, Joe Biden and his advisors, they had to know, they have to know, that Iran wouldn't take this lightly. Is this the U.S.'s way of basically entering the fight, saying, go ahead, I dare you, shoot at us, and then we can join the war?
I don't think so. I don't think the U.S. actually wants to directly enter this fight. This is most likely a strategy by President Biden to shape the Israeli retaliation to those Iranian missile strikes on October the 1st.
How would that work?
So the U.S. is really keen that those Israeli strikes don't target Iran's oil and energy infrastructure. They fear that that would lead to a retaliation on other energy infrastructure in the Gulf, in Arab states, which are allies and partners of the United States, and that that would send energy prices soaring just before the U.S. election. So I think this is intended to be a carrot that President Biden is giving to Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in the hope that it shapes and limits the scope of that Israeli retaliation. Of course, the danger is that now President Biden has already announced that this system is going to be deployed to Israel. It beefs up Israel's defenses and perhaps even further emboldens Netanyahu to feel that he can strike even more sensitive targets in Iran and will be better defended against a Iranian retaliation.
Will Todman is deputy director and senior fellow at the Middle East program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Mr. Todman, thanks for your analysis. Thanks for your time today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Here's some other stories we're following from around the world. A UK foreign minister will attend EU foreign affairs talks for the first time in 2 years. Britain's David Lammy will join with a group of 27 EU foreign ministers for talks in Luxembourg on the Middle East and the war in Ukraine. Lammy said the government was determined to reset our relationship and deepen ties with our European partners in order to make us all safer. Lithuania's center-left opposition Social Democrats will attempt to form a majority coalition government together with two other parties following the country's parliamentary election. Early results showed them ahead in the election, which was dominated by concerns over the cost of living and potential threats from neighboring Russia. Kamala Harris used an appearance Sunday before a largely black church audience in North Carolina to call out Donald Trump for spreading misinformation about the government's hurricane response. Trump is the most prominent among those promoting false claims about the Biden administration's response to hurricanes Milton and Helene. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Karish in Washington. Time now for American politics and the election. The American Psychiatric Association says that as elections approach, stress levels for voters go up, regardless of political affiliation. The constant stream of news, stressful arguments, and concerns about the country's future all put pressure on mental well-being. Some psychologists are calling it election stress disorder. VOA's Maxim Adams has the story.
The November 5th presidential election caused an anxiety for nearly three-quarters of those surveyed in an American Psychiatric Association poll. Some psychologists are branding this phenomenon election stress disorder. Lynn Bufka with the American Psychological Association.
The political climate and discussions about the election had become a lot more heated and a lot more divisive. And we wondered if that was having an impact on individuals. And certainly their self-reported experience of it was that indeed that has been a significant source of stress for many individuals. And other research has also found similar kinds of results.
Political stress affects many aspects of life, says University of Nebraska-Lincoln political science professor Kevin Smith.
A fifth to a quarter of Americans reports ruptured social relationships, maybe even problems at work because of politics.
Smith's research shows that young people, as well as those with left-leaning views and those more involved in politics, are more prone to election stress.
We know how to mitigate the health effects. It's just stop paying attention to politics, just tune out. The problem with that is that might be good for individual health, but it's not particularly good for civic health.
Stress management specialist Dr. Kiran Dintiala, known as Dr. Kam, recently published a book called The Mantra of Peaceful Politics, where he shares his advice of how to avoid excessive stress during the pre-election period.
Elections come and go. Politicians come and go. It might change their future, maybe 10%, 20%, maybe 30%. But for most part, their future, their happiness depends on what they do every single day in their life, their behaviors, their emotions.
But Bufka says there is a way out of the psychological malaise. She says it is all about exerting control over where you get your information and also about doing something, anything, instead of doom-scrolling political stories.
Constantly exposing ourselves to negative information, negative images, negative rhetoric is going to elevate our overall sense of negativity and stress. So we have some control there. Another thing that we encourage people to think about is engaging in meaningful activities, whether it's related to the election or to current societal issues or problems that are important to you.
APA stresses that it's important to remain calm and maintain social relationships, as spending time with loved ones. An active lifestyle and healthy eating and sleeping can all help reduce anxiety in the days before the election. Maxim Adams, VOA News, Washington.
And while the election may not be good for the mental health of voters, the physical health of the candidates is definitely an issue. Arthi Tharapayan of Reuters has that part of the story.
Democratic presidential nominee Vice President Kamala Harris released a letter from her doctor on Saturday, pronouncing her to be in good health and fit for the Oval Office. According to a Harris aide, the move was made to draw attention to Republican nominee Donald Trump's refusal to release his medical report.
And it's just a further example of his lack of transparency.
Harris spoke to reporters before boarding a plane to North Carolina.
And it is clear to me that he and his team do not want the American people to really see what it is that he is doing and whether or not he actually is fit to do the job of being president of the United States.
In a memo distributed by the White House, Harris's doctor said her last physical exam in April was unremarkable and that she maintains an active lifestyle and healthy diet. It noted she suffers from seasonal allergies and sporadic hives, which have been well managed with medications and antihistamine treatment. In a statement, Trump's campaign communications director said that Trump has voluntarily released updates from his personal physician, as well as detailed reports from the medical doctor who treated him after the first assassination attempt. In 2018, when Trump was in office, a White House doctor said he was in overall excellent health, but needed to lose weight and start a daily exercise routine. The Harris campaign is eager to highlight the former president's age of 78, since he became the oldest candidate after 81-year-old President Joe Biden stepped aside from the race. The campaign hopes contrasting Harris's comparative youth and mental acuity with Trump's advanced age and tendency to meander will convince undecided voters that she is more fit for office.
That's Arthi Tharapayan of Reuters with that report for us. Moving now to Eastern Europe. Changes announced by Russia to its nuclear weapons policy were long overdue and will probably cool the enthusiasm of its Western enemies. This according to Belarusian leader Alexander Lukashenko in an interview released on Sunday. Lukashenko is a close ally of President Vladimir Putin. He said hotheads in the West had already heard the nuclear signals being sent by Moscow even before the Kremlin leader announced the changes last month. Putin said on September 25th that Russia was extending the list of scenarios that could prompt it to consider launching a nuclear weapon, including if it had reliable information about a massive cross-border attack against it involving aircraft, missiles, or drones. The announcement was the Kremlin's answer to deliberations in the United States and Britain about whether or not to give Ukraine permission to fire Western-supplied long-range conventional missiles to hit targets deep inside Russia. And finally today, Bangladesh is busy reforming institutions after an uprising in July and August that ended Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina's 15-year rule. As VOA's Sarah Zaman reports from Dhaka, Hasina's brutal crackdown on the mass protests has deeply scarred society.
Farida Begum plays the same video again and again. It shows a glimpse of her son, Mubarak Hussain, the day he was shot. On July 19, the 13-year-old was injured as police fired at anti-government protesters in a Dhaka neighborhood. He died the next day. Farida Begum says the protesters had a slogan that the deluge of our blood will wash away injustice's mud. She says, I asked him, son, what does this slogan even mean? He said all his brothers were protesting. Several hundred protesters died across Bangladesh between July and August as Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina's government tried to crush a student-led mass uprising. The iron-fisted ruler fled to neighboring India on August 5. Months later, the injured are still recovering in hospitals, many facing a lifetime of disabilities. A metal brace holds Mehdi Alam's leg together. He says all of it makes me disheartened, but it also makes me happy. We managed to overthrow the fascist ruler Hasina from her throne, he says. Our country gained independence. Our nation became independent for the second time. For that, we're overjoyed and proud. But those who supported Hasina's party, the Awami League, now fear revenge attacks. Abu Talib, a leader of Chhatri League, Awami League's once powerful student wing, has left his room on the Dhaka University campus. He's also staying away from social media to avoid being tracked.
So I feel very afraid every time. I feel uncomfortable everywhere. If anyone know me and I feel if they harm me. Right now, I don't participate in master's degree because I am part of league. The general student don't allow me to join the class.
At the peak of the protest, Chhatri League members and anti-Hasina student protesters clashed in towns across Bangladesh. Deadly violence has also occurred since Hasina's fall. Bangladesh's chief law advisor Asif Nazrul says supporters of the ousted regime have nothing to fear except accountability.
We are committed to protect constitutional rights of every citizen. We are not committed to protect the killers of July massacres from trial or from public allegation or public criticism.
Alam wants exemplary punishment for Hasina, who has been implicated in more than 200 cases, mostly related to protesters' deaths. He says, we, the people of Bangladesh, want Hasina to be brought back to Bangladesh so that she can be punished as harshly as legally possible. This must happen so that any new government in Bangladesh does not again dare to do what Hasina did. For Mubarak Hussain's parents hanging on to his last memories, it may be too soon to think of the future. Farida Begum says he used to buy coal for his eyes with 10 takas and donate the remaining 10 to the mosque. She says, I couldn't give him those 20 takas. He never came home after prayer that Friday. Pain, pride, and fear as Bangladesh recovers from a brutal crackdown on a historic uprising. Sarah Zaman, VOA News, Dhaka.
And that's going to wrap it up for today. This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com. In Washington, I'm Steve Karish.